Welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a vodcast and podcast show that brings you leadership lessons, knowledge, experience, and wisdom from thousands of successful individuals from around the world. I'm your host, Ashutosh Garg, and today I'm privileged to welcome a very, very senior professional, a technology leader from Japan, Mr. Nalin Advani. Nalin, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me here, Ashutosh. It's a delight.
Thank you. Nalin has been a technology CEO, a board member, and an investor. He has led technology giants like Wind River, Barco, and Grey Orange in Asia. And he just told me he also did a stint in India. He is a board member of Nihon Unisys. So Nalin, with such an exceptional career that you've had in the tech world, let me start by asking me that your journey to the top has been not in one, but several iconic organizations. What did you do right? What were your learnings and what were your challenges?
Okay, thank you. I mean, that's a great question and makes me reflect a little bit on, you know, the earliest part of my career, which was essentially, so I was born and raised in Japan. And the earliest part of my career, more by coincidence than by design, I had an opportunity to run the Japanese legal entity of a US Silicon Valley company. Okay. And that was a launch. It took me about 3 years to launch it, make it successful, after which I was ready for a slightly bigger challenge. So I, very early in my career, actually, I did this situation where I would launch or turn around the Japanese legal entity of US tech companies. Very often they came into Japan, they made a wrong hire. They hired a very accomplished gentleman from one of the large Japanese industrials who was not really well suited for these roles. And that also created an opportunity for me to go in and turn those companies around. So very early in my career, I did do a few of these startup turnarounds for tech companies in Japan. And later that morphed into a kind of an Asia Pacific profile.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, and as someone who was born in and raised in Japan, what have been some of your learnings and your challenges as you have tried to integrate Japanese culture with the country of your origin, which is India, and having worked for large American corporations?
Yeah, and I think you have to look at this two ways, right? Many people look at me and say, you know, how can you be an Indian person in Japan running Japanese entities? How can you be an Indian person in Japan on the board of a large Japanese systems integrator that's publicly traded? And I think about that. I think probably this is both the challenge and the opportunity, which is I'm not Japanese. I'm not Indian. I'm not a startup guy. I'm not a big corporate guy, but I'm all of the above. So while not being any of them, I'm also all of the above.
Right.
And probably because I can see it from both sides, I'm also in many ways better equipped to bridge between, say, a startup and a corporate, or between Japan and the rest of the world, or between India and the rest of the world.
Well said. So now I'm going to move on and ask you a little bit about the kind of work that you're doing or have been doing. And that is relating to building startups or running large companies. And it's often been said, you need one skill set to start up and another skill set to scale up. What are your differences? What are your perspectives on the differences in skill sets you need as far as people, competencies, experience are concerned between scaling up and starting up?
Sure. So I think in a traditional large corporate environment, people are rewarded for stability, consistency, rigor, and execution. In a startup, emerging companies, we're rewarded for imagination and innovation, right? So how we are rewarded and how we engage with our work, how we engage with our colleagues, how we engage with our ecosystem and customers is very different. I'm not going to say one is better or worse than the other. I think at different stages in my own life, I have enjoyed being both on the corporate side, but I've also enjoyed being able to take those learnings, leave behind some of the the learnings, take some of the better ones and apply them in a startup or an emerging industry or emerging company.
And could you share some examples of these learnings in the startups that you have been investing in?
Sure. So a lot of what I do thematically is comes down to either digital transformation or comes down to automation. So if you look at what I did early in my career, it was the software that went into robots. And this was with startups from the US who grew into large companies, went public on the NASDAQ. And I was involved in getting that software into Japanese robots, which was quite interesting because Japanese robot companies were, you know, saying, well, we'll use Japanese software. Why should we use American software? But what I learned there now still applies in the robotic startups that I'm involved in today, starting with kind of going full circle from what I was doing in Japan in my late 20s, early 30s, to what I'm doing now in with my startups in Singapore and India that are also in the robotics space.
Okay.
And so it's interesting to see how the circle completes from, you know, from corporate to startup, from Japan to India to Singapore, and also from hardware to software.
Wow. My next question to you is that, you know, we're just coming out of the pandemic, and each one of us have been virtually locked up in our own homes or countries for the last 2.5 years. And yet work is carried on, and there are these things that are happening of work from home, the great resignation, et cetera, et cetera. As a senior leader, if you were to build a team in one of your startups that is growing fast today, what would you look for people who you'd like to bring on board?
That's a very real question. I'm doing this even now, Ashutosh, because the startups that I have invested in and I'm mentoring, I am very much there with the founders in the recruitment process. Right. So even now I'm hiring people, interviewing and trying to, you know, try to find out with the leadership or the founding team, who are the right people to bring in and at what sequence. But right now, especially in a post-pandemic, the emergence of a post-pandemic world, I still think there's a lot of tag-along effects from the pandemic. So, and by the way, that's also created a new set of skills in people. And I would say, I still think it's this agility with a strong sense of ownership, independence with a strong sense of collaboration. So, and I know these sound like they're complementary, but also contradictory, right? And when you're looking for somebody who's independent, you want somebody who knows when to be independent, how to be independent, how to mentor the next group of people to be independent, but be able to do it in a way that they're collaborating. So even though we might be working remotely, we might be working across geographies. I have a robotics startup right now that is, it's headquartered in Singapore, but it has people in France, in Vietnam, in India. Technically, I'm here in, you know, split between Singapore and Japan. And our sense of collaboration is what really makes us much more competitive than other people. Likewise, with the sense of agility, the ability to know when it's time to adapt to a customer or when it's time to request the customer to adapt to us. That's a very keen sensibility to have. And you can get that when you have a very strong sense of ownership about your technology, your value proposition, and the market that your customer is playing in.
Fascinating. So let's move and talk a little bit about valuations and value creation. You know, it's a well discussed debate all over the world. What creates value? And I was talking to a startup founder who had just become a unicorn, and his company was losing huge sums of money. And he actually told me, he says, well, you need rare talent to lose money and build value. So I thought, I'm going to ask this question from all the top corporate leaders that I speak to. What determines value? Is it the venture capital? Is it the stock market? Or is it actually going back to basics and saying a business has to be profitable?
You know, ultimately, it's the customer who decides what the value is.
Correct.
really, it's, you know, what is the customer, what is the market willing to pay for your service, your technology, your capability, your support? So I think, you know, it's not the VCs, it's not the stock markets. But having said that, when you have real customers who are paying real money because they recognize real value in what you're doing, then I would say your ultimate valuation comes from the stock markets if you are a publicly traded company.
Correct.
And why is that? Because the stock markets are very carefully watching what your customers are doing, how much they're willing to pay. If you look at the indicators, whether it's earnings per share or, you know, whatever indicators that the stock markets and the analysts prefer to look at that point in time, but it's usually driven by how much business you can do. When you're a startup in a much earlier stage, then it's the VCs who have a bigger role in figuring out what your valuation is. They're the ones who define you, but they're defining you on not on what your customer is willing to pay for you, but on the nature of the risk that you are taking and the potential upside of that risk. So the VC assumes a different, they're assessing you on your odds of succeeding and how big of a bet you're making.
Right.
Right? So it's different stages. Ultimately, it's the customer, but at an early stage, it's the VCs and the investors. And finally, when you are able to list, it's the stock market.
Well said.
May I make one other comment here? I often tell the founders that I work with, and I've been very blessed. I've had two IPOs from my own of my own investments and one exit through a trade sale. But you know, I don't think an IPO is an exit. I don't think an IPO is something you aim to and then you list and then you get out. The fundamentals, and maybe I'm a bit old fashioned, but you do an IPO to raise money because, you know, it's, you're raising a larger sum of money from the market because you're going to do something with that money you raise, whether it's building new technology, putting in place more people to secure more customers, or perhaps even an acquisition of, you know, an adjacent player in your industry. But I really think the value of an IPO is in getting money in a very different way than you'd get it from a bank.
Fantastic. So moving on, let's move to the world of technology, which is the world that you have grown up in, if I can use that term, and still live in. And you have also, you're also in Japan, which has had some very, very large technology companies who have also seen some significant shocks. So I've often said that, you know, incumbents and traditional companies sometimes are not able to embrace change as easily as small emerging companies. So I want to get your perspective on what do some of these big traditional companies around the world need to do to adapt to the new market dynamics?
Sure, no, that's a great question. Again, it goes back to a little bit what I was saying, right? Traditional companies are rewarded for execution and consistency, whereas startups are rewarded for imagination and innovation. Correct. So the question is, how do we bring imagination and innovation to traditional companies? And how do we frame it in that setting of you know, being able to execute with consistency? The companies that are doing this very well have continually reinvented themselves. Right. If I can point to one company that you know, that I have personally been quite involved with and I worked at for many years, it's a company called Barco. Right? It's a B-A-R-C-O, as in it started out as the Belgian American Radio Corporation. And 100 years ago, it made radios. And it went from, you know, a consumer brand for radios to a B2B brand for audio equipment to a B2B brand for imaging. And then, you know, it's been the pioneer, the wave has already kind of peaked, but it was the pioneer in taking the cinema industry digital from, you know, from going from 35 millimeter film to compressed files on hard disks that are encrypted to watch in a cinema, and then doing the data and analytics around who's watching what and when. So I think you will see companies who are able to reinvent themselves over and over again to adapt to their environment and adapt to the shifts in the industry are the ones who are successful. The challenge is, of course, when you have an existing business that is too big and you didn't see it coming, that the startup is, you know, that little startup came in and did something innovative, and now all of a sudden they're nipping at your heels because you are about to go obsolete. It's very difficult. But again, that's another reason why large companies these days have CVCs, corporate venture capital. So they put money into startups, including a few of the ones that I've been involved in. Mm-hmm. And there's a synergistic relationship because they get to see what we are doing, and we get to use them as a go-to market. I hope I've answered your question.
Well, you have, absolutely. And yet I have a follow-up question on that. And that is that large companies, how easy, I mean, Barco is an amazing example, and I've read about everything Barco did, and I didn't realize that you had led it at that time. But what are some of the constraints that large companies have to be able to pivot easily?
The most obvious one is when you've got an incumbent business, right? And you don't want to cannibalize that. You don't want to, I mean, Kodak is the perfect example. When I go back to the Barco example, right? Barco did not invent digital cinema. Kodak did. But Kodak could not embrace and scale that business because they were worried it would kill their traditional film business. Right? So I think the first answer is the fear of cannibalizing your existing market leadership position. Second is leadership, the leadership mindset. If the people at the top don't understand that, you know, that the wave you're on is about to, you know, it's ebbing and you've got to ride your next wave, you have a problem. So I think it's really important that leadership and companies have to be able to spot that next opportunity and then ride that wave 2, 3, 4, 5 years before it really peaks. Well, again, I hope I've answered your question.
No, you have. I mean, I think all my viewers and listeners will love your answers. So I have time for two more questions now. And my next question is that I want you now to wear your hat and look at a crystal ball and the digital world. And my question to you is, what do you say or what do you think are some of the top 3 or 4 digital trends? And you probably have already answered the first one, which is robotics, because you're so deeply involved in it. But I'd love to get your perspective.
Okay, so I mean, and you know, depending who you ask, of course, you'll get very different comments. For me, there's 3. And the first is definitely not just robotics. I would say automation, both physical and digital.
Yeah.
So the idea here is any task that is repeatable, anything that can be done through a cut and paste should ideally not be done manually because we have more and more the tools to automate and the tools are getting better and better. And not only are they getting better, they're also getting predictive. So not as it, you know, in the past it was, I would manually do something and then it's become, well, I don't need to manually do it because I can automate it. In the future, it'll be, well, how do I predict what's going to be, what needs to be repeated? And how do I automate that repetition? Or how can I prevent something needing repetition and just fix it once and for all? So I think this is the first one. The second one is, it's a bit related to this, but I think it's very much, you know, when we look at enterprise and industry versus government, I see that government in many cases trails industry in terms of digitization. So I think there's a huge trend right now, an opportunity and a trend for more and more digital and e-government, digitization of government services. That'll do several things. It'll bring down government costs. It'll apply tax revenue in more effectively and efficiently. And it will make our lives a lot easier, whether it's as a consumer, whether it's national, you know, medical insurance, filing our taxes. I'm a resident of both Japan and Singapore right now. I pay taxes in both countries. I'm so impressed because in Singapore, it takes me most recently, including making a cup of coffee in the middle, it took me 8 minutes and 45 seconds to file my tax returns.
It's very efficient. Right?
Yes, it is. And I think, you know, so that's the second one. The third one is not a technology trend, though technology will be applied to this, which is, you know, having a sense of connectedness and belonging. And the pandemic has, you know, has created this requirement because many of us are operating across geographies, across divides that we never really thought about before. Yeah. So having a sense of connectedness, having a sense of belonging, whether it's to a small team, a large organization, an industry, or a trend, I feel is going to be very, very important going forward.
Fantastic. And my last question to you, Nalin, and this is for the many, many people who will listen to our conversation. A lot of them are very young professionals from around the world. Given your amazing background, your track record as a senior corporate professional, as an entrepreneur, as an investor, what would you say are three lessons you would like my viewers or our viewers and listeners to take away from this conversation?
Okay. Thank you. That's a great question. And, you know, Ashutosh, I have so much respect to see you doing what you do and the joy with which you do it.
Yeah.
And so my first lesson is learn from Ashutosh, which is
that's very kind of you.
Which is, if you're not enjoying what you're doing, correct, then, you know, then it's do something else. And you know, watch people like Ashutosh, because he really enjoys what he's doing. I think I enjoy what I'm doing too. So maybe you can learn from both of us. Yeah, but absolutely. That's the first thing, right? If you're not enjoying it, move on and find something that you enjoy.
Correct.
The second is keep learning no matter how old you are. Mm. Right. So, and I know you're asking me this question for your young audience. I consider myself young still. And, correct, you know, I did a master's degree at 40 while running a company. I learned to swim together with my daughter at 45. Mm-hmm. I started learning Mandarin at 50. Uh-huh. And I recently completed my certification for Sogetsu Ikebana, which is a form of Japanese flower arrangement. It's the way of flowers. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I did that at 55.
Wow. So I think,
you know, keep learning because that will help you with the first part that, correct, I talked about, which is the joy in your life.
Correct.
And the third thing, which is, you know, please know that you, each one of us and each one of you, have great amount of impact on your personal branding. Mm. And so please take good care of it.
Wonderful. Nalin, on that note, and the three amazing pieces of advice, which is do what you enjoy, keep learning, and be very conscious of your personal brand. Thank you so much for speaking to me. Thank you for talking to me about your amazing journey as a corporate leader, as an entrepreneur, as an investor, taking two companies out of your own portfolio to an IPO and would do one trade sale is more than I can think of many, many other investors from their portfolios. Thank you for sharing with me so many experiences and stories that you have personally been through and involved in. Thank you again for speaking to me, and good luck.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed the conversation. And again, all the best to everybody who's watching this.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.